Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Ask the Industry Podcast, episode 109. I'm comedian Simon Kane, and for those of you new to the show, this is the podcast where I interview the most influential people from the worlds of stand-up, comedy, radio, and today, TV writing. Arthur Matthews is an Irish comedy writer and actor who often collaborates with his writing partner, Graham Linehan. He has contributed to a number of TV shows, including Harry Enfield and Chums and The Fast Show. The writing pair also created the hit sitcom Father Ted, and on his own, he wrote the TV show Hippies. We got into if he prefers to write alone or in a writer's room or in a partnership, what it is like having your partner achieve a higher level of fame than yourself, and does stuff get easier to make once you've had one hit under your belt, and more. If you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. 5 stars would be the dream, but if not, a 4-star rating with a review that reads like a 5-star is just as good. Either way, please do consider joining the Facebook group. It's the best place to ask your questions to future guests before they come on. It's called Ask the Industry Podcast, and it's on Facebook, obviously. But for now, before I hit play, I just want to put 2 quick shout-outs in here. One to promoter and comedian Chris O'Neill for helping me put this together. He was instrumental in finding me a room to do this in Dublin while I was on tour out there. It's very hard for me when I'm touring to find central locations to record, and he was instrumental in putting this together. Also, while we're on that note, we recorded it in the basement of a Costa Coffee outside Trinity College in Dublin, and in the basement, it's actually quite echoey. In the record, it didn't sound as echoey for me as it did in the edit, so I have tried to remove as much as possible, but unfortunately, there is still some in there, so I just wanted to sort of flag that up and let you all know that I am aware there is some echo. I also want to thank Jack Gilchrist, who helped me get him on and sort of organised all of the logistical fiddly bits at the other end. So thank you very much to both of you. Before I hit play on the podcast, I just want to say that I have signed up for the Edinburgh Festival and I am currently previewing a show around the country. I won't go on about where and when that's going to be right now, but if you want to take a look in the show notes and have a look and see where I'm going to be previewing and where I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival, that would be great. I really appreciate seeing some of your faces at these shows. It's always lovely to have the audience come down and say, hey, it's me, I'm the person who tweets you, or hi, I'm a regular listener and I love it. So if you could come down to a show, that'd be really appreciated, and or the Edinburgh Festival. And if you're not able to come down, if you could just pass on the message to a friend who's in the area, that would be massively, massively appreciated, and I can't thank you enough for the support. But now, without any more delays, this is Arthur Matthews.
My first professional writing credit was, it must have been Hot Press magazine, where I worked as a layout artist, not as a writer, but I contributed amusing pieces to Hot Press. So I think I was probably paid for that. I did a thing called The Border Fascist, which was a joke, Irish provincial newspaper. So I'm not sure if I was paid extra for that, or if it was part of my wage for being a layout artist, later art director. But that was pre-computer, so it was just sticking bits of paper down with Kogel.
Laborious task.
No, it was a laborious task. And sometimes I used to lay out the type in columns, but they wouldn't match up. So that didn't, I did that one month, the first week I was there, the second week I did that. And luckily the editor was okay about it. Yeah, so I just did a few cartoons and things in Hot Press, and funny articles, or supposedly funny. And then I went to London, I met Graham Lennon, and he was a music journalist in Hot Press, and he decided to go to London and write for Select magazine, so he asked me to come over, so I went over. And the first job I did in London was actually, I did cartoons for the NME. Stuart McConey gave me the job, actually, in 1991, that would be.
How old were you then?
Very old. I was over 30. Graham was young. He's 9 years younger than I am, but I was over 30, really, but I'd been in Hot Press quite a while, so I decided to leave it and just... I thought I'd go to London for a few months and then just see what happened and then just probably come back to Ireland just see how it went. So I spent the first 3 months really just going to all the football grounds, one a week, spending half the budget. But it was good in those days, you could just pitch up at the ground and just pay in, unlike now, where it's really hard to get into football matches. But yeah, that's what I did in London. So, and then we wrote a radio script for Lenny Henry. That was the first thing we did that we were paid for, I think. Yeah.
So what were you doing for the first 30 years? Like, did you?
What was I doing for the first 30 years? Not very much.
I can't remember. Did you want to be a writer, or was it?
No, not really. I didn't really. I mean, I drifted into it because I left school. What'll I do? God, a few months to go until I leave school. What'll I do? I don't know. Good at art. I'll apply to the art college. Oh no, I've missed the deadline for that. So I applied to another art college, an inferior art college, which is now really good, actually, but at the time it was a bit haphazard. So I did graphic design, and if I had my time again, I'd probably do fine art, but I did graphic design. So did that 4 years, did a year in the Students' Union, did a few years of doing courses like a screen printing course, a wall mural painting course, or all just to complete, just to get people off the dole that put them on these kind of courses. And then I did illustrations for newspaper, which I'd never get paid for. So I had to sue them to get money off them. So I eventually ended up in Hot Press when I was, 25, 26. So that was my life journey.
Yeah, because, and I mean, in a non... judgmental or insulting way, it's just like you said, it's later. I mean, it's about right, I think, for most people to get their first like big break professionally in writing, like sort of in their 30s. But it just seems like you like you said, you drifted into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
in a way that I think's not gonna, it wouldn't wind anyone up, but it'd be like one of those things where some people work really hard and they don't get into it, and it's sort of quite a nice story of the sort of, I don't know. What's the word? It's like sliding into it in a very organic way.
Well, I did. You see, well, what happened was, well, I was in bands as well. I was in a few rock bands. I was in the Joshua Trio, which was a irreverent U2 tribute band involving donkeys and Jesus. So I did that with Paul Woodfull, who was a friend of mine in Hot Press. We were both doing the art department layout thing. And then Graham pitched up in Hot Press, and that's how I met Graham. So really the reason I got into writing script comedy is because of Graham, because if I hadn't met him, I just wouldn't be doing it at all.
So was he sort of, was it like a moment where you both said, we're going to sit down and write together and do stuff, or was it a case of you didn't?
Well, no, we did a kind of comedy sketch group thing with Paul, me and Graham, but we only did that, performed it about once or twice, and I was doing a few comedy things with Paul as well. But anyway, Graham decided to go to London. He said, do you want to come for a few months and we'll do a bit of writing? So that's what happened. And when we were writing sketches, we sent them to Smith and Jones. So that was the break, really, Smith and Jones. We were living in Griff's flat because he had loads of, as he got increasingly rich, he got all these he'd accumulate houses. So he had one house in, of all places, Kilburn. So he lived in his house in Kilburn for a while.
That's forgotten the production company, Griff.
Talkback.
Runs Talkback, yeah. So it was sort of right place, right time, if you like.
Absolutely, yeah.
Because you were, because to pitch a sketch now, a writer would have to send it into an info app Talkback sort of thing and hope that no one just deletes it. Whereas you were on his sofa.
Yeah, we just sent it in to Smith and Jones, and Jim Pullen, who's a script editor, he got back to us pretty quickly and said, "Oh, Mel and Griff kind of like this." So, and like, that was complete meritocracy, because Ireland didn't work like that at all. You had to know, not to get anywhere, you had to know someone. And but Jim was very good to us. And then before we knew, not too long later, we were in Smith and Jones, the boardroom in Talkback in Percy Street, and Mel and Griff were there, and like, we were just chatting away to them about sketches, ideas, because it was amazing, because, like, you know, I was a fan of Not the 9 o'clock News and then a last Smith and Jones later, so it was a thrill. And Griff, you know, we knew Griff particularly well. Griff was always just great to us, you know, really generous. So that was the break, yeah.
So you said in Ireland it was more of a meritocracy?
No, completely the opposite.
The opposite, okay.
Completely the opposite.
So is it still that way now? Is there more of a structure in Ireland?
I've no idea.
You don't do it, like, you just live here?
I just live here. Yeah. I just live here. I don't know what's going on. I don't know. I honestly don't know what the story is.
Has it become more of a meritocracy than in London, do you think?
Well, I don't know.
I don't really take part in it. Are you just established enough now that it's sort of like you can just pitch things and they'll listen?
No, not at all. I pitch loads of things and none of them get made.
Relatable.
I mean, it can be frustrating. I mean, I think, I've been around a while and I've had, you know, some success, but it's still quite frustrating. So if you're starting off and you can't get a break at all, that must be really frustrating, you know? Very, very little of what I pitch gets made. I mean, you know, small proportion of it.
Well, yeah, but statistically, if everything you pitch got made, then the channel would be you.
Wouldn't necessarily be a bad thing.
No, but I'm
for the public.
I'm not saying it's bad, but what I'm saying is that I think even getting a percent, even like a 1% through, is always
there's quite a lot than I'm not complaining, but it can be frustrating is what I'm saying. But even, you know, mostly, even though a lot of the sitcoms I've pitched don't get made, you know, I usually get paid for writing a script at some stage, but it's a struggle, you know.
Yeah, like a spec script, just so they can sort of get an idea of it, or a pilot type thing.
Well, so, you know, I'd what would I do? Let me think. I'd pitch an idea, and then I'd go to a production company, really, probably. And then, what would I do? Sometimes I'd write it up and not get paid. Sometimes I'd write it up and get paid, get commissioned.
Do you write like a whole half an hour script or like a 10-page thing for 10 minutes?
I recommend writing scenes. Like, if you're going to pitch something to someone, I'd write, you know, what it's about, who the characters are, and a few scenes and a few potential storylines. That's really the best way to go. But some, you know, rather than write a 50-page. You know, summary of what it's about. Just sample scenes are much better, I think, you know. Even to demonstrate what the characters are like.
Well, is it... Because there's now more channels. So on paper, you'd imagine there would be more writing opportunities. Not necessarily for the individual, but for writers in general.
Yeah.
Do you find that that is the case? Or do you find that there's a lot of syndication channels, for example?
Syndication channels.
So, like, remember when Dave started, it just took a load of stuff off the BBC and just showed it over and over again.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose there are, but there's a lot of... It's not a brilliant time for comedy, I don't think. I mean, I was in London in the early 90s, and that, I think, was just Vic and Bob were big then. Armando and all that, today, or On the Hour, all that stuff was starting off. And then we were asked to write for the Fast Show. We did a bit of Brass Eye as well. So it was just a great time. So I always think that it kind of started with Harry Enfield, and Vic and Bob and Armando and all those people, and kind of Peep Show, I thought, was the last really great show, I thought.
I really love that.
Yeah, it's brilliant, and it just got better. I mean, I always think it's probably the best written show ever, and part of that reason is because they're articulating people's thoughts in it.
Mm.
And, like, you can be much more articulate with people's thoughts than dialogue.
I thought they ended it at the right time as well. I felt like they could have easily got another series.
Yeah. But I mean, it still did, like, 10 years or whatever. Yeah. It was a long time. But it was just so good. I mean, I think, yeah, I regard it as the best written sitcom ever, probably. It's that good. And casting, of course, is very important in it as well. Great cast.
What do you mean when you say that comedy was better in the 90s? You've obviously...
I mean, it was better in the 90s.
No, but, like, obviously comedy is so subjective. I mean, like, what was allowed or what was... tolerated, what's sort of different then?
Well, now I just think there's a lot of it is very low key, and
as in like easier jokes or quicker,
just not as many jokes, low key, not you know, not big laughs, low key is what I mean. I mean, I was kind of sacked from a program recently because it wasn't low key enough. That wasn't the reason given, but I'd written this with someone I knew, and the producer suddenly said, yeah, I don't think it's working. I think we need to go down the, and she mentioned a low-key, no-laughs show. So I was kind of sacked off for trying to make it too funny. Well, that's what I say. Obviously, it's not what she said.
Yeah.
But, and just like lots of things, like the way things are filmed now with the shaky camera thing. Kind of drives me nuts, because I mean, there's a place for it if you're doing an action sequence, but when two people are talking quietly and the camera's still jerking up and down, like, there's some comedian I actually really like, and I was sent a link to his show, but I just couldn't watch it because all you could see is the picture frames and the window frames and the door frames going in and out of shot in the background. So it just kind of drives me mad. I got kind of obsessed with this director called Joanna Hogg. And she did a few films. She did one called Archipelago, which I really liked. And she does these aren't comedies. These are very, very deeply serious films.
Is that the Scottish Highland, the archipelago, that bit?
Tom Hiddleston's in it. They all go to this island, and it's a kind of family, and they're all fighting.
Okay.
But she just does wide shots, locked off. Camera doesn't move at all, and very naturalistic and realistic. And I thought, well, that'd be a great way to go with comedy, to get away from the kind of jerky camera thing. But that's just an idea I've had that will never see the light of day.
But do you think that's because tastes have changed? Do you think that's because the way that people... I mean, obviously with on-demand players and with people watching it on their phone, like almost their hand is acting as part of the shaky cam, adding to it on
the
phone.
Well, I think it may have been... I think suddenly... sitcoms with audiences, we did Father Ted, obviously, with an audience, and they suddenly fell out of favour with the critics, and people saw them as very old-fashioned, and then The Office came along, which I really like. I mean, The Office is great, and Gervais is great, but I don't really like that mock documentary thing, and I think did he say that he felt a bit constricted by it at one stage? Once he'd done it, he thought it was a bit of a stretch. Maybe he didn't say that at all. Maybe I'm completely making it up. But in fact, I saw the latest, the Ricky Gervais Office, David Brent on the Road.
Oh, the film?
I thought was very funny. You know, Brent's a brilliant character. But really, and that was supposed to be a mock documentary, but really it wasn't, because after about 10 minutes, you just forgot it was a mock documentary. And it didn't do... Like, it had a proper narrative and a story. And so it wasn't really a mock documentary. What he did get out of it was the kind of David Brent to camera pieces where he just sound off about stuff. But he probably could have done that by just him talking to someone else. But it's just, I mean, The Office is terrific, but as a genre, the mock documentary thing, there was just too much of it. And I think it lets people off the hook as regards storylines and, you know, proper telling a story. You know, it was kind of a lazy thing. Also, of course, the other brilliant one was Spinal Tap, which was fabulous as well. But as a genre, it just began to drive me mad, especially all the shaky camera stuff, which is even in drama now. I was watching this ITV drama, and they'd even film things from, like, outside the house, like, through the window outside the house. So it looked like everything was from the point of view of some stalker who was in the bushes.
Yeah.
So a lot of shaky camera stuff is like that. It's like the point of view of a stalker who's hiding in the bushes. So.
And you're not a fan of that. You're not a fan of people
hiding in the bushes.
No.
No, I don't. I don't.
I should get that on the record.
I don't think everything should be filmed from the point of view of some stalker in the bushes. No. But as I said, that Joanna Hogg, I got obsessed with those films, and I thought, well, that'd be a great way to go completely the opposite.
Hmm.
But. Yeah, I just think there's too much. I mean, there should be a variety of stuff, you know, and there is now because you can watch so much stuff, you know, and like Dad's Army is on still all the time. It's great. And The Office is great, and Peep Show is great, and all these kind of shows. But I just think there's too much low-key, no-laugh stuff now.
But, I tend to agree, and I don't really watch that many current sitcoms unless I literally just need something to fall asleep to.
That's not what they're aiming for.
Not in an nasty way, just in a, I like having something on in the background when I sleep. So,
yeah.
And there are certain shows that are perfect for just...
Could you not have the radio on rather than the television?
I've got Netflix now, so it's all
on Netflix
there.
On?
Yeah, I just leave it on.
Why don't you just have the sound on?
I like the colours moving in. So I face away from it, I like the colours moving.
Okay, whatever gets you through the night, or not.
Yeah, if it's quite bad. If it's on low enough volume, I can sleep with it. If it's on a high enough volume, I get invested in it, even if it's awful.
Really? Yeah. I don't have Netflix.
I only got it recently because my dad wanted it, and I found out that you could have two logins on it, for the same price. So now we split the cost of that. Everybody.
Well, my sister has it on her phone, so when I'm in her house, well, that's where I saw the David Brent latest. His stand-up thing.
Yeah.
Which is great. I mean, Gervais is amazing because he wasn't a stand-up, and then he thought, oh, I'll just do stand-up, and he turned out to be really good stand-up. So I have a lot of time for him. You know, he's great.
Mm. So when it comes to stuff like Netflix and watching stuff online and watching stuff in different ways, when you're pitching an idea, do you ever, BBC Three moved online or completely now, do you ever think, oh, this will work on this channel, so I'll go to these people, or do you go to
you'd go to a production company, really.
Right.
Like, I have a good relationship with Objective, who did Toast, with Matt Berry.
Oh, they're Darren Brown's one, aren't they? Oh, they work with Darren Brown.
Yeah, Darren Brown. In fact, that's how they kind of started off with Darren Brown, I think. Mm. And that kind of magicians. Because the head of who found the, I can't remember the name of the guy who founded Objective, he was a magician, I think, and good mates with Darren Brown.
Yeah, they picked him up.
Him. But anyway,
it's going to bug
so
me.
So Ben, I know. Look it up online.
I'll Google it.
What advice is that?
yeah.
Tell you what you can do. Actually, try and look it up online.
I tell you what, you talk. I'll Google, and we'll just that'll be the hour.
Anyway, Objective, Ben Farrell there has been very good to me. So I'd go to Ben with an idea, and he'd say, well, you kind of know yourself, really, you know, that's something, you know, I mean, young people is, you know, young people's sex, bit of vulgarity. BBC Three, Miranda is BBC One. I mean, you know yourself, like most people would know.
Yeah, I think... If you don't know the channels, A, they've got style guides up there and things they're looking for, so you should sort of do your research before you send it in. But I'm wondering at your, and I kind of want to say level, but I feel like every time I say that, you're sort of looking at me as if to go, what are you on? It's all the same, no matter what you've done, sort of thing, which is interesting to me. But
I could probably bend someone's ear.
Yeah. Well, you want them to look, you don't want to...
you know, I know, I mean, yeah, I'm not saying I don't have contacts in the industry.
God, that sounded so much more sinister than I was expecting.
No, it is. It was meant to be sinister.
Okay, good. Then I'll edit me out saying that.
I have contacts in the industry. Yeah.
You've done your time.
I've done my time.
Do you find, because it sounds really, and I mean this in a non-insulting way, but and you're probably aware, Graham's name, I feel, is slightly more well-known than yours.
Yeah.
Commercially speaking.
Yeah.
Do you find if you pitch something, because obviously you've written sitcoms on your own before, like since your partnership.
Yes.
Do you find pitching stuff with him, so for example, the Father Ted musical that you're kind of working, or the last, I couldn't find much about it, like there's so little, it just, every article says, they're working on a thing, Trump helped it, which is, I found really amusing. But that's, and I assume that's because that's the stage in production that you're in. But I'm assuming when you pitch with him, is it easier then? Or?
Well, yeah, Bob. Well, what the Father Ted musical has come about because Hattrick, who are the production company who did the TV show, have been on to us for years about doing a musical. So we didn't really pitch it to them. And I was kind of never that pushed about it. But Graham suddenly had some inspiration about it, which does involve, which, you know, has he said, he's probably said this about Trump getting into power inspired him. So, yeah, so.
Can I just say it inspired him because if Trump can do that,
yeah,
Ted can become Pope.
Exactly.
It's not him watching Trump win an election going, well, look at how good the world is.
I don't think so.
No.
I don't believe that's the case.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that was easy. That was an easy sell.
Mm.
I wasn't even a sell because they came to us rather than me or Graham going to them.
What made you not, I mean, obviously there was the title character kind of died off right at the very end of that and stuff, which kind of, if you were going to do a fourth series immediately, would have made that tricky or there would have been stuff to work around. But like, what was it, a case of you just didn't get a fourth at that point, or you wanted
we didn't want to do anymore anyway.
Okay.
We kind of thought, well, we'd done 25 at that point, so that was probably enough. Because of the nature of the show, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a serious kind of real world with, you know, totally realistic characters. It was more lightweight than that, so we thought 25 is probably enough, you know.
Did you have any ideas for the show that couldn't get made, or that the channel or the production company said, we can't do that for budget reasons or taste reasons? Or
for what? For which?
For Father Ted.
Ever?
Yeah.
No, not really. I mean, in those, like when we did Father Ted, we got very few notes, really. We got some from, very little from Seamus Casley. He was the kind of commissioning editor at Channel 4. And he commissioned that. We'd done a sitcom with Alexei Sale called Paris, which wasn't a success. But Seamus still commissioned Father Ted. But he had very little to say. And Jeffrey Perkins was the producer. And he'd give us notes. But nowadays, like, I mean, you get notes from the producer, you get notes from the production company, you get notes from the channel. And I was even talking to someone recently who said that they can now get notes from the people who, like, if you, like, the way Talkback is being bought by Fremantle, they end up, all these companies end up being bought by other companies. So ultimately, Shell Oil owns everything. So now you get notes from Shell Oil as well. So that was like four set, like that was in the old days, Seamus Casty had practically nothing to say about, he just let us get, it was like a football manager being appointed, just let him get on with it. So Seamus had very, there was something about a Catholic theological point at one stage he was a bit worried about, but otherwise he didn't get involved really. But nowadays you get just a pile of notes, which I don't remember 20 years ago. I don't remember that happening. I mean, I've done something recently, and before it even went to the production company, before it went to the channel, I had 10 sets of notes on it, and like really long notes as well. Having said that, the person who gave me the notes was very good, and it's funnier as a result. But a lot of the time, I found as well that people who give you notes were almost never, it was almost never about making the show funnier. It was nearly always about plot and storyline and that, really.
I've got like two questions there, but I just want to quickly clarify something for anyone listening that doesn't quite know the structure of this. So you have an idea. You let's say you just want to write it for this point. You don't want to kind of take it to anyone. You just want to see where it goes. So you write it. You then send it into a production company.
Well, yeah, or you could send it directly to
a channel.
The channel, yeah.
So if you'd send it to a production company, which you had in that case, they'll look over it. If they like it, they might send you notes, or if they know you, they might bring you in and go through it.
What they do first, they'd probably come in and you'd meet them, and if they liked it enough, and they'd say, just write more of it, you know. And then at certain stage, they might try and get Channel 4 or the BBC or Sky or whoever to pay for a script commission. I think I think production companies now, I think I'm right about this, they nearly always try and get the channel to pay rather than pay themselves.
Who would send it? Would you send it, or would your agent send it on your behalf?
Well, if you've got an agent, but like, if you don't have an agent, just send it yourself.
No, I'm asking for you. For you.
Oh, for me?
For you, yeah.
No, I'd send it myself. If people I know, like Objective or the Rough Cuts, for instance, I'm doing something with, I just send it to them, really. But it's fine to do that, you know. My agent really deals with the financial matters, mostly.
So the first step, so say you wrote something, sent it off, it got commissioned or they liked it, the first step, the first time your agent would know about that is when you say, oh, we've got the contract now.
Ah, no, I mean, I'd send her a copy.
I'd
tell her what was happening.
You know, you CC her in sort of thing.
It wasn't I pitched up at the Oscars collecting best script.
And, I'm here. Sorry, I haven't replied.
And she never knew about it. No, I mean, you know, she's very good. She rings me up a lot and keeps me up to date.
Well, I'm asking because there's a lot of misconceptions around agents and what they do and what they don't do. And a lot of the time when I talk to people, they go, well, my agent does this, this and this.
Yeah, well, I think it's different. Maybe if you're a performer, it's different. Because I remember we were with the Talkback agency and we were with someone called Melanie Copeland. And Melanie, I think, more or less left to become Graham Norton's manager. So she's not just his agent. Or she was. That was a while ago. I'm not sure if that's still the case. But she was very much looking after Graham in every kind of way, really. You know, but so it's probably different from performers. But mostly in my case, I would say it's dealing with the financial kind of aspect, not exclusively that. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that there's no need to go through an agent to get your script sent somewhere. Is basically what I'm trying to say.
So, just going back to the point you said before then, where you said the notes that came back were mainly not to make it funnier, but to improve plot or to...
Well, mostly, yeah. I mean, not all the time. As I said, I've done this thing for Rough Cut, and my script editor there was very good, and as a result, even though it was a pile of notes, it has improved it, you know. But in the past, sometimes, I just got notes which really didn't improve things much, or moved it sideways, or you know, didn't really do much, and a lot of it. But as I say, they're mostly about plot, and rarely about how to make things funnier.
Is plot secondary importance for you then?
It is. Yeah, but it's still important. I mean, I think casting is hugely important. I mean, I've Matt Berry asked me to do his Toast show, and Matt is just so brilliant and so funny that it doesn't really matter. You can give him anything and he'll make it funny. I've just listened to his radio show on Radio 4. Have you heard that? Where he cuts up.
Yeah.
That's brilliant. He just uses old actual interviews with people like Simon Callow, Kent Williams, and use the original, their part of old interviews, and cuts them up and interjects his old questions. His own questions, and puts a bit of music in it, and it's just hugely inventive and very funny. But Matt is just one of those people who, he doesn't, you know, it's the way he says things, and he just has that naturally funny thing. So you don't have to do much in a way, really.
Okay. No, I just wondered, because as someone who is writing stuff at the moment,
yeah,
for me, I find when I come up with the plot for an idea for, say, an episode, that helps move parameters to make the jokes work within the sort of situation, well, if you like. So that's why I was interested in you saying that pushing the situation isn't necessarily the right move.
Well, I would, I mean, it is important, right, and to tell a story, you have to tell a story. But like with Father Ted, a lot of the time we just think of scenes, and we think of the scenes first, or scenarios, and then shove them into a plot, rather than the other way around. That was, I can think of lots of things, or bits where we did that. That was the thing. Wouldn't it be funny if Ted, like, there was a bit where he had a car that he'd won in a raffle, and he dents it slightly, and he thinks, oh, I'll try and fix that. So he just taps it a bit, and then you cut layer, and he's wrecked the whole car because he's just, you know, hammered it to pieces. So that was an idea we just put into a plot, rather than coming up with the plot first. But having said that, you do have to tell some kind of story, and you know, usually it's nice. I mean, it's satisfying if you have a kind of main plot and a subplot. But I still think, I think casting is hugely important. If you can get someone like Matt Berry, or you know, Tim Key, I like a lot. Whenever I write things, I nearly always find myself thinking Tim Key would be very good in this.
Do you get my saying casting? Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely, yeah. Even on Father Ted, when we weren't that experienced, I knew Dermot, so Dermot got in. I knew Frank. I didn't know him personally, but I knew his work from Irish television. Ardle I knew personally, and the only one we didn't know was Pauline McLean, who played Mrs. Doyle, who came in through the casting route, and that she was auditioned for it. But the other three we knew. It was kind of different because we were Irish and they were in Ireland, so Channel 4 or Hattrick wouldn't have known, really. But yeah, they just said, yeah, these are the right people for it, so yeah. Oh no, yeah, I'd always want to be involved in casting, because if someone's miscast, and you know, the whole thing's in big trouble.
So when you're, so, because who was the person I was talking to? Slipped my mind, but they said never think about who you'd want to play the part, because you'll only be disappointed if they won't do it.
Well, yeah, you will be disappointed if you know.
They also said it's more work when you have to rewrite it for the person that you ended up settling for.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, the counter argument to that is, like, it's easy to write for someone if you have someone in mind, then it's just easier to write, I think.
Would you ever, if, say, for example, you wrote a script and you wanted it to have an extra boost for someone to take notice of it, would you ever get some people together and do a table read and maybe record it and send them a audio version of it, or maybe even a video version of sort of a
yeah, scene? Yeah, sure, yeah.
Do you do those?
No, I don't do those because... I'd suggest people, like, it's just Tim Key, I'd suggest, and people that know who he is. But yeah, if you're starting off, it's kind of unlikely you're going to get Steve Coogan to come down and read your script. But there's absolutely nothing wrong if you're a performer, writer, and you know people who you think could do your script, to do a table read and just record it. I mean, I can't see how that would be harmful, unless it just wasn't very good, you know.
Yeah.
Which, in case if it wasn't very good, then that would be incredibly harmful.
Mm.
But I did a table read with something I wrote in about 2000, and the cast in it was incredible. It was like Simon Pegg, Rebecca Front, Catherine Tate, Ben Miller, Alexander Armstrong, Kevin Eldon. I say Kevin Eldon. Tracy Ann Oberman, amazing cast. And so we did a table read of that, but that That went nowhere. So even with the cast like that, you know.
So we're saying his names don't matter.
Well, no, they do in a way. I'm just giving an example of my astonishing cast that I got together for a table read, and it didn't get made. What's the moral there? I've no idea.
TV's fickle.
TV's fickle. I think they went for something instead that was just cheaper to make, I think.
Yeah, I was going to ask if there was ever a... Because, I mean, who I think it was Space, Simon Pegg's thing, was the original, let's see if we can make something on a proper budget. Yeah. And then America did it a few years ago with Dr. Horrible. Did you see that? The sing-along blog?
No, I didn't see that.
It was when there was a writer's strike, and they had, like, Neil Patrick Harris and Felicia Day and just, like, really big names for there, who all got together and on, like, no money just made this, like, very low-rent... supervillain versus like supervillain who falls in love with this person who like he can't have because he's trying to get into the evil league of evil.
Yeah.
And it was just so silly and so beautifully done.
Yeah.
But it was done on like no money because they were trying to prove a point where like you're in the writer's strike of going, we can do stuff on low money.
Yeah.
Why not work around these premises rather than, you know, sort of do that? And I suppose with channels always competing for attention, especially with more of them, there's either you invest money into it because you think throwing money at something will make it better, or you throw money at writing and talent and it just is better even though it's not going to cost you as much. And I suppose, what's your experience with kind of budgetary restraints, just holding back ideas?
None. I've never been really aware of budgetary. Anyone telling me you can't do that because it's going to cost too much. Very rarely, or if they do, you can normally tweak it so it's the same joke but done in a slightly different way.
Mm.
I never remember feeling frustrated about budget being a problem, really, ever, and because people are very inventive and can find ways to do things. And shows look so much better now than they used to, you know, because generally they're not studio sitcoms with video cameras as opposed to film cameras or film effect cameras, whatever they are now. I mean, Toast looked great because the director, Michael Cumming, was able to... it was shot on location, whereas with studio-bound sitcoms, they're always kind of going to look pretty much the same. But it's not a studio... it's not a director's medium, really, studio sitcoms. It's kind of largely a technical kind of a job, but when you get them outside in the studio, of the studio, the director can be more creative.
Hmm. I interviewed Michael Redman for this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember talking to him about what... he basically did like two gigs in Ireland and then realized...
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
He'd be doing those two forever if he stayed here.
Yeah.
So moved to London and started gigging there in order to kind of build
yeah.
His skills up and stuff.
Yeah.
And I wondered, because when I spoke to him briefly about his role in Father Ted and the impact that that had for Ireland, what impact in your perspective did it have for the Irish scene and for Irish comedy?
I suppose it raised the profile of Irish comedy, but then that was, that happened at the same time as Dylan Moran, as we call him, and Ardle and people, Tommy Tiernan, kind of, and Sean Hughes was a bit of a trailblazer, I suppose. But I suppose, I mean, there are people, friends of mine who are in Father Ted who are still doing stand-up based on their appearances in Father Ted, like, so that's a big selling point for them. And, you know, fair play to them. So, I suppose it put Irish comedy on the map. That's a cliche if ever there was one. Yeah. Yes.
So, and going back to the point we were talking about before, we were saying how channels have changed and there's more of them. Mm. Obviously, since you started writing, social media has become a thing.
Yeah.
And that obviously means that when you put out some work or if you write a sketch, even if they don't know it was your specific sketch in a show, you can look out for immediate feedback on that from people rather than the TV channels and the commissioners. Mm. Do you do that? Do you ignore it? How has that impacted your writing a bit?
Well, no. Here, one of the best ideas I ever had, which I'm really proud of, it might be my favourite idea, it was to do a Sex Pistols Bill Grundy interview from 1976, to do that exactly the same, but with Amish people. They're all dressed as Amish people. And I was flogging, I originally written this for a Big Train sketch show series we did, and the third series was never made, so it wasn't in that. So then I remember taking it to Harry and Paul for their show, Harry and Paul Whitehouse, and Paul said, yeah, I like it, but Harry doesn't want to do it. So it was still not being done. And then Kevin Eldon, he got a sketch series, so I said, Kevin, do you want to do this? And he said, yeah. And they did it, and it was brilliant. It was just that Sex Pistols interview, but they're all dressed as Amish people. So Matt Berry was in it, and Peter Serafinowicz was in it. And Kevin, obviously, was in it, playing Johnny Rotten. And then, so that was on YouTube and got lots of hits. But brilliantly, Simon Pegg told me that he told Kevin that Simon Pegg was bowling with Steve Jones, who's Sex Pistols guitarist out in LA. And Steve said, yeah, I really like that sketch. So that was, yeah, I love that. That was one of my favourite ideas I've ever had to do that, because it's not a writing thing at all. It's just an idea. You don't have to write anything. In fact, I didn't have to write anything. I said, Kevin, look, here's the idea. So they just looked at the original and just copied it completely, except they were dressed differently. So I'm not sure if that's relevant to your question, but was it one of those things that was up on YouTube and a lot of people saw? But you haven't seen it, have you?
I haven't seen it, no. But I am going to look it up now. Literally just writing a note.
Anyway, Steve Jones of the Sex Pistols really likes it. Great.
What's nice is about the reach on things like that, because obviously Sky and stuff has sort of, not a limited reach, but it is limited in the sense that because it's paid for subscription, and same with Netflix. But whereas if you put something up on YouTube or if you make something like a podcast, it can just go to anyone.
Peter Serafinowicz has always been pretty clever about that stuff, and he's made...
The Sassy Trump at the moment.
The Sassy Trump, yeah. And also, the Partridge stuff was great. The Foster stuff with Tim Key was brilliant. And, like, of course, that was done with no budget, probably, because all you have to do is stick them in a studio and do, you know. But also, I mean, it's helped that Partridge is now kind of the right age. I mean, I know they're doing, they've probably finished another BBC Alan Partridge series at the moment. But finally, he looks the right age as well, because they could never make him look anything other than a young, boyish-looking Steve Coogan.
Yeah.
But now he's finally the right age. But it's
grown into it.
He's grown into it, yeah. And the recent stuff has been great, and the stuff he's done on Sky, the specials have been great as well. They're kind of, in a way, I suppose, to make the sitcom, which is brilliant, look. I suppose, because of the studio audience, maybe it looks a little old-fashioned now. I mean, you could say that for Father Ted as well, but it's really blossomed, like, you know, and very subtle. It's probably more subtle than it was in the TV studio. Because Armando Nucci came along. When we were shooting Ted, he came along to some of the recordings because he wanted to find out how to do a sitcom. So I was very humbled that he'd come along. Wow, Armando's asking us questions. But then they shot it in the studio where you couldn't really see. Like, normally you have three walls and the front one's open. But they had actually kind of four walls, so that the audience couldn't really see.
Why did they do that?
Just so, be just more authentic, I think. Or so it's like easier for them. Easier for them.
So it made the audience the stalker that you hate. So it made them look in through the house.
Looking through the windows, But because we had a small role, acting roles in that, and it was very different from the way we did it, because they, on the day, the scripts were coming in, on the day, because we'd always had them well prepared in advance, but on the day they were coming in, I remember actors hanging around. And I think they were quite long, those shows, and they had to edit them down a lot. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's still brilliant. It's one of the best shows ever, you know. But it was just a different way from the way we did it. But, man, I mean, I loved his Stalin film. It's brilliant. Just so good. Yeah. Just terrific. And I know Ian Martin a bit, who wrote on that. But it's one of those shows you think, God, I'd love to have done that. Also interesting in that it's very much an ensemble piece, in that it's not one or two leading actors. There are kind of five equally prominent characters in it. But yeah, it's terrific piece of work, yeah. But Armando's probably the most important person in comedy over the last 35 years, I imagine. I always think of him, you know, Chris Morris, all that crowd. Rebecca Front, all those actors, and Marber, and all those people, with On the Hour and the Day Today, and Coogan, and Knowing Me, Knowing You. That was one strand. The other strand was Vic and Bob doing Big Night Out and all that. I mean, it was hugely exciting. We went to the recording of one of the Smell Ofs, Reeves and Mortimer, and it was just, you really felt, wow, this is an exciting place to be, at a very exciting time for comedy, you know. It was really like, you know, it's like Haight-Ashbury in 1967 or Carnaby Street in 1966. Stroke 67, maybe through to early 68. But anyway, it felt like an important time.
What's really nice about when you talk about just collaboration and working with people, it's just really nice to hear, like the level to which none of it feels, so I've interviewed other writers and some of it feels a bit like, well, I was a head writer and there was a team, and sort of that kind of dynamic, and all the way you talk about things, I've never felt, or I haven't felt, yeah, anyway, that you felt like there was someone above you or below you, or it just feels like there's a team there that you work with, if you like. And I was going to ask you, like, you've written scripts on your own, in particular, like Hippies, the sitcom, for example, where you wrote most of that solo. How did you deal with writing alone, and how did you deal with not having like someone to bounce ideas off of?
I don't mind not having anyone to bounce ideas off.
Okay.
You know, you can just not have arguments with anyone. You can just write it, and there it is, and it's less conflict. But it's not, I'm not saying it's that means it's better, but it's just easier, you know. I just find it easier. But as I say, that doesn't actually mean it's better. But it swings and roundabouts, I suppose. But I don't mind writing on my own at all. And the old days, like when I was writing with Graham, the sitcoms and Big Train and stuff. Not in Big Train, before that, like we were living together and sitting down at a computer, even a word processor, a pre-computer in the early days, and we just write together. But now, does anyone do that anymore, actually sitting around? I suppose some people do, but I've been doing something, a script editor with David Earle and Joe Wilkinson, who are brilliant, actually, very funny. And they, despite the fact they both live either in Brighton or very close to Brighton, they just write like on Skype or something. They don't actually get together in the same place. So that's the modern world. But I think even Richard Curtis and Ben Elton doing Blackadder would just write separately. In those days, they'd post the scripts to each other. But actually, talking about internet.
Sorry, what?
Talking about the what are we talking about? What's kind of, you know, people doing solo stuff without not on mainstream television channels. Matt Berry put me on to David Earle's Kumbo character, which is really, really funny. He's just this brilliant character. And I don't know if you've seen it. If you haven't seen it, it's Kumbo and David Earle's just this kind of loser guy in Brighton who's, you know, the wrong side of 30, nearly 40, and he's still kind of hanging out with the kids and going to all-night raves and stuff. But it's brilliantly funny and well-realised character, you know. So that's as good as anything I've seen on mainstream TV recently. And like podcasts, which have nothing to do with BBC or anything, that I listened to Julie Davis's recent one with Vicky Pepperdine called Joan and Jericho, which is really, really funny. It's kind of two agony aunts but dealing with the most horrifically gross, grotesque, rude problems.
Use the toilet. They're just closed downstairs.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Do you need the toilet before
no.
we? Okay. We've got about 10 minutes left, and they close the toilets before the end of the place.
Fair enough. Yeah. I can hold out. So yeah, that's the John Jarrick is really good. I was watching 90/90 again recently, and Julie's terrific because Toast was a bit like that. I hate this kind of twee vulgar kind of comedy, which is like people saying poo and wee and all that stuff. I hate that. So if you're going to do kind of that kind of stuff, go way over the top. Like Toast was a bit over the top. But it's all or nothing. The middle ground of wee and poo jokes is just
Gooch.
Horrendous. Just awful. Whereas John and Jarek is pure filth, but in a very funny way. That's my take. I just hate that twee vulgar stuff. I was at one stage working in Radio 4 as a kind of, I had a regular monthly meetings with about four or five people who would look at scripts coming in and comedy ideas while the producers would present. And a lot of the scripts were that kind of twee vulgar stuff, which I just really hated, you know. So it's all or nothing. If you're going to go down the sex route, just make it really grotesque or don't bother at all. That's good advice.
Well, you know what's going to happen now, don't you? Just going to get loads of people tweeting you going, oh, I've got this really great idea. Anal fisting or something.
Yeah. No, not that. That's not.
That's too far.
There's something wrong about that. I don't know why. John and Jericho. Listen to John and Jericho and you'll get the right kind of way to go. I think it's you have to treat it in... Like, they as these kind of two very middle-class, Middle England, home counties, agony aunts, they can talk about it in a kind of... that kind of homely kind of way, but what they're talking about is really outrageous.
How do you discover podcasts and YouTube stuff? Do you just go searching, like, sort of just to kind of get the ball rolling in your own head, or do you listen to recommendations? What's your process for discovering stuff?
No, I don't get too many recommendations. Matt Berry told me about the David Earle thing. I read about Joan and Jericho in the newspaper. I don't know. I mean, I'm not. I don't know what's going on, really.
Well, glad to have
no idea what's going on. I've absolutely no idea. Although I have organised my YouTube videos. Have you done that?
Yeah.
Well, I just have lots of kind of mostly music videos, to be honest.
I've had an account on YouTube for me to watch for about 10 years, and I've had one for me to make stuff for about 4.
Yeah.
And the one that I use for watching, I've always been quite pedantic about categorising into playlists.
Yeah.
So, I there's probably loads of
that. I'm quite organised. I kind of like that. But having said that, there isn't much comedy stuff. There's a lot of Saturday Night Live stuff. I mean, obviously with Trump and Alec Baldwin, that's kind of a godsend. That's pretty funny. But there's a lot of Christopher Walken. Did you ever see the Christopher Walken one where he's a birthday party and all the other Christopher Walkens come?
No.
It's very funny. But we always, when Graham and me were in London in the early 90s, we used to watch a hell of a lot of Saturday Night Live. It was the kind of Dana Carvey, that's his name, and Mike Myers era, Phil Hartman. So we watched a hell of a lot of that. And it still has its moments, Saturday Night Live. But the... Yeah. But, you know, what else is going on?
Do you think watching a lot of that has influenced the way you write? Because a lot of Saturday Night Live is very punchy and...
I don't know. I mean, you think what you like. You know, I was hugely influenced. I had this someone gave me a book years ago, 30 years ago, more, by this Canadian illustrator and humorist called Bruce McCall. He used to do a lot of stuff for National Lampoon and stuff, the New Yorker. And it was a huge influence on me. It's one of the funniest books I've ever read. It was a collection of all his pieces in National Lampoon and all those kind of magazines. And it's just really, really, they're kind of bogus or fake catalogues for the Titanic. And he had an obsession with 1950s American cars. He's a Canadian-American guy. And that was hugely influential on me. And it's bound to have an influence, you know, all that kind of... Whatever you look at and absorb, if you like it, it's bound to have an influence. I mean, it has to.
When you first started writing, looking back on it now, do you see any echoes of writers that you enjoyed in your early work?
Yeah, I do. I tell you what, I think Father Ted was very like... I think it was very like Reggie Perrin, The Rise and Fall of Reginald Perrin. I think I looked... I liked that show a hell of a lot. And that was lots of catchphrases in it and silly moments and kind of slightly surreal. So I think that was a big influence on the actual sitcom writing, you know. And stuff like The Young Ones would have been as well, I suppose. Monty Python, you know, people of my age, Monty Python is really, it's the Beatles of comedy, really. And so that was that, and then there was Not the 9 o'clock News, and then there was The Young Ones, and then I think the biggest effect of all was Reeves and Mortimer, really. And that was like comedy being the new rock and roll, with Vic on the cover of NME and that. And then, as I've said a lot, then Armando and Chris Morris and Coogan come along and all that stuff.
When was
very exciting, all that stuff. The Fast Show, all that stuff. 90s.
I was just going to ask, when was the first time you wrote something and you felt like it was entirely your voice? Like there was no influence from like your heroes or from places that you'd seen. It was even if it's something that never got made, when was the first time you wrote something and thought, that's me?
Well, I'd say I wrote a book called Well Remembered Days, which, I mean, there's no interference on books. There's no one to... And it doesn't go through any stages of casting or filming or editing.
Yeah.
So it's all you, like, you know, there's no one else to blame if it goes wrong. But that was I loved it. That was just this made-up Irish character who'd lived through the 20th century and was all about Catholicism and nationalism and religion and, you know, the IRA and just that world I remember growing up in of 70s, 60s, 70s Ireland and the revolutionary generation in Ireland. And it was just all that mixed up. Actually, here's the thing. This sounds like bragging, which it is. John Peel did a show called what's it called? A good read? No, it's not a good read. Maybe it is a good read. And he selected that as his favourite book of all time.
Nice.
And I was humbled. I was genuinely humbled. And Matthew Paris was the other guest. And he thought it was racist. And
I mean, that's less of a brag.
And this guy, what's he think he's doing? And Peel, we knew Peel a bit because he was in Talkback. His agent was a woman called Kat Ledger, and she was the agent for my book, Well Remembered Days. So we knew Peel a bit, and we used to go for a lunch with him and that. And I mean, he was just such a huge, iconic figure, you know. To hang out with him was pretty extraordinary. But, you know, terribly nice guy, because he got in touch with us because out of the blue, he said, oh, I've seen your show, it's really good. And he sent us a postcard.
When he said show, did he mean Father Tell?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And he just out of the blue, he wrote, was, oh, I really like your show. And he sent a postcard of scenes of Crouch End. There were four, a postcard divided into four with scenes of Crouch End. And there was one of this vegetarian cafe called Banners. And Peel is actually in it. He's actually sitting as one of the customers, just completely coincidentally. So he sent us that postcard. Yeah, I mean, it was brilliant. We met Stephen Fry quite early because Griff, we went to a play that Griff was in, and we met Stephen Fry. He was really nice to us. And people are very, very nice to us and very, very generous, you know. Alexei Sale was very good to us. We did this sitcom with him, then we wrote for a sketch show. It was just really interesting that people were so open and we'd come from nowhere, like, you know, and people were very willing to meet us and they were just really generous to us, you know. And Griff still is just, I love Griff, and he's still kindly invites me to his Christmas party every year. So, yeah, we were really lucky, really lucky.
When you first started getting paid for writing work, did you ever feel like an imposter? Did you ever feel like you, at some point they were going to find you out and be like...
No.
No, you always felt like you...
I thought, this is fun, and... No, I actually never felt like that at all. No, not at all. I've always been, you know, quite confident about the right, whether you like it or not, or however it turns out. You know, I can always sit down and write something and be quite confident about that, you know. Whether it's good or not, or whether it ever gets made is another question. But no, I've always been quite confident about that.
And how did you start to get to know what was good written down and what would be good acted out?
Well, we learned pretty early on that you have to keep dialogue pretty short and not have, if something on a page is like half a page of dialogue, it's gonna, when someone reads it out, it's gonna seem like it's an hour long. So we learned pretty quickly to keep that kind of stuff, dialogue, short. Keep sketches short. Shouldn't be more than a page and a half. Even if you feel, if you can't stop yourself doing four pages, cut it down to two pages. Also, make things visual. Rather than just dialogue-y kind of jokes, have lots of visual jokes in it, which, you know, which are brilliant, you know. I mean, but I always think of the Likely Lads, whatever happened to Likely Lads, when you see that programme, it's really just two people talking. There really isn't much action in it. I mean, it's good, like, it's obviously good, but it could just as well happen on the radio, really. Whereas we were always very much up for visual gags, because they nearly always kind of work. The audience nearly always likes them, you know. Mm. Whereas people talking to each other I've just slagged off the Likely Lads, which is one of the most successful sitcoms ever.
I genuinely thought you were slagging off this podcast.
No. This is highly entertaining.
If you've made it through an hour of this. Well bloody done.
Yeah, so, anyway, keep things short and put lots of visual gags in. That's my tip for success and happiness.
And probably don't be afraid to do more than one take.
we had in studio recording of Father, we had some actor in once who just couldn't get the line right at all, and he kept having to read it. He just lost his nerve. His nerve went. And he kept having to do it over and over again. Of course, you know, if you do it 50 times, one of them is probably going to be usable. And then when you see it in the show, you never know. It's fine. Actually, people, live studio recordings, people love when you make mistakes anyway, you know. They just love it, so you can't really go wrong.
Mm. Well, everyone likes a bit of schadenfreude.
They do.
Yeah. What I've got is, hang on, let me double check to make sure I've not missed out any key. Oh, there was, okay, yeah, there was one other thing I wanted to ask, which is about when you were writing, so Father Ted, series one was over, and you had series two on the way. What was it like trying to meet expectations for either the channel or the fans for you and Graham? Like, what was it like pressure-wise?
No, I didn't feel any pressure at all. We just continued what we were doing. You know, I've just never had any kind of fear of doing that kind of stuff. There was no pressure. I didn't feel any pressure at all. We just did what we did. Plus, now we could imagine, because we'd had a solid, tangible series, we knew who the actors were and what they were going to do and how they'd do things. So that was easier. Plus, we probably had lots of ideas left over from the first series anyway. Plus, you know, we probably got enough time to write. I don't think that we were ever under much pressure. But people just let us get on with things, really. And, you know, it's fine. It was just easy. I never found it hard. I've written some of the new Ted musical, and it's just really easy to write those characters, you know. It's not hard. It's just not really hard at all. I never thought Father Ted was hard. It might have got hard if we'd done another few series of it. But it's just, I don't remember it being difficult at all. I think there was one or two. There's one Night of the Living Dead, which I think, where they're all zombies, which we could never really probably finish it off properly, or the second half probably wasn't great. But people still kind of like that show. It had enough stuff in it for people to like, you know.
If you could go back and redo that, those three series, or if you could go back and change any element of how you pitched it, what would you go back and do now based on your knowledge of...
Well, I wouldn't do anything different because it worked out.
Okay.
You know? There's things I've done where I would have recast things, not Father Ted. I mean, certainly, obviously not in the major roles. There's one or two minor roles you think, that's not quite right. Now, I've suffered a bit from things I've written being miscast. But then again, yeah, you can't blame... You know, you have to take responsibility yourself for the writing, you know. But having said that, I can think of a few things where things I've written have been badly miscast and as a result haven't worked out, you know. If that doesn't happen very often. And as I say, generally, I'm given a big say in the casting, you know.
If for example, you got to a stage where they said, well, we're doing it with this character, we're doing it with this person regardless, or we don't do it at all, would you ever then rewrite some of the script to fit the new person so it works for you?
You could do that, yeah. Would I do it? I probably would, but it's so unlikely that would happen, really, you know?
Okay.
I can think of two occasions where people were, excuse the term, forced upon me. And it wasn't a pleasant experience, really, but that's rare, you know, that's pretty rare. And a lot of the time, I mean, if you write for someone like Matt Berry, then it's just not going to go wrong. There are people I always, as I said, Tim Key, Simon Farnaby, I like a lot, Harry Peacock, there's lots of people I kind of like. So you can have them in mind. I did a thing with Ingrid Oliver, it's very good. If you have people in mind, you can suggest them, you know, and a lot of the time people will be open to that, you know.
I have the last quick fire questions. Quick for me, you take as long as you want to
quick
answer.
For me, slow quick for you, slow for me.
Exactly, that's the way I deal with it. Okay, So what is the biggest mistake you've ever made and how did you overcome it?
Well, I worked with someone I shouldn't really have worked with and I didn't overcome it.
Was it grime?
No, it wasn't grime, no. It was not grime then.
Fair enough. What is the most common misconception people have about your job and what do you tell them to counteract it?
A misconception? God. Wow, that's quite a good question that I'm struggling to answer. How would you answer that question if you asked yourself that question?
What about being a struggling
misconception?
I don't think there's any misconceptions about.
Well,
the
let
level
me see.
That
I'm at. Oh, well, I think a misconception is people probably always think the actors were right.
That's true. Yeah.
People always think, oh, Dermot Morgan's it. Dermot must have written that. I don't mind that at all. I don't know. Do people have misconceptions about what writers do? Maybe they think we're all often in. Maybe they think we go to a big office somewhere and get like loads of bottled water brought to us and sandwiches every day of the week. But most of the time, I'm just at home writing.
The only misconception I've ever had about my writing work is people sort of think that it's constant laugh. Like I'm just chucking jokes out all the time, and we're going, we've got too many in here, mate. Let's cut this down. And it's not half the time. It's like I've got this idea, and the other person's going, "Yeah, I don't like that idea." And like, but it is a good. And they go, "Yeah, but not for today."
Yeah,
so
yeah,
we'll sure, bank yeah. it, and like in a few yeah. weeks we might come back. And so it's more like negotiating what we're going to develop more than
yeah.
anything yeah. else. That's my main experience of
absolutely. Yeah.
And that bugs me a bit because then you can see it in their eyes at a party. Like if you meet someone, that's why I don't go to many of them now because everyone's sort of like disappointed by the fact you're not constantly the chuckle factory they think you
oh god yeah no wow well that's a big pressure. I mean, imagine what it's like for Ricky Gervais or Steve Coogan or you know the performers to be
do you like kind of not being as well known as them?
I think so. Yeah, it must be a lot of pressure.
Would you have ever wanted to be as famous as say Graham is or
as famous as Graham is?
He's quite famous. Do you not think he's...
Well, he's picked up an amazing Twitter following. I don't see myself as in those terms, really. I know what you mean. I do know what you mean. I never think about it, really. I don't really think about it. I wouldn't like to be... In the A, you know, the Ricky Gervais. I mean, it's great in many ways, obviously, but I don't think I'd like being recognised all the time or knowing people would always be aware of who you are, you know. I don't think I'd like that very much.
What is the biggest problem in the TV/writing industry and how would you go about solving it?
Wow, that's a good question. The biggest problem,
other than shaky cams.
Well, yeah, okay, I'll go for shaky cams.
Oh no, you can't. You already.
I've already.
You've
said
already
that.
Extensively said.
No, thanks for reminding me. Yeah, shaky cams.
No. Oh, it was the second.
Second biggest problem. I think that you know. I said this already. I'm sorry to be boring about it, but I wish there was a bit more kind of great. You know, funny, God, this sounds so simple, but just funny shows with big, funny characters in it without having to be, you know, completely over the top. You know, just room for more, you know, Matt Berry should be just in every comedy program, I think, really. And that would be kind of good. I'm not sure there are enough young writers coming through at the moment.
How would you solve it?
I don't know. Maybe it's cyclical. I don't know what it is. I think it probably needs someone to come through who is really doing great stuff on YouTube or something that everyone can like and it's really funny. And I'm just not aware that there's anyone really like that, you know? I mean, you probably have your ear closer to the ground and this kind of stuff. I mean, when I saw, like, you know, when Matt put me onto that combo character David Earl does, I thought, wow, that's great, that's so funny. But, also, I have to say, I've been writing with this, they're called The Pin, which are a comedy sketch.
Oh, yeah, the sketch group, yeah.
Yeah, and they're great. I mean, I love their show.
They've got a great dynamic.
They've got a brilliant dynamic, and it's kind of classic, you know, double act. And so they're really good. And they're young. They're genuinely young.
Yeah.
You know, because when I think people are young, that's like they're still 35.
Do you think the industry, the TV industry, is geared... Because the live circuit is very much geared towards finding the newest person, which often means the youngest. And every comedian will tell you they're better 20 years down the line, as every writer is. Do you think the TV industry is geared then towards younger people behind the scenes as well as in front of the scenes?
Well, I mean, it's fair enough that it's aimed at young people. I mean, that's, you know, that's fair enough. But I just don't see the great talented young people coming through. You know, I'm sure people disagree about that, but I'm not hugely aware of anyone.
Okay, thank you very much. Last question. I normally say, what's the biggest bit of advice you wish you had when you started? But I'm going to sort of change it slightly and say, what would be three writing tips you wish you could go back and tell yourself?
Three writing tips. Maybe I've tended to go too wacky and too weird at certain points. And it's very hard for me. It was probably difficult for me to stop doing that because instinctively it's what I've done. It's what I would do. So there's something I would say to myself. Maybe keep it a bit more grounded. But then again, some of my favourite things I've done have been pretty over the top. But yeah, I do look at some things and think that was a bit too much. That was too big, too crazy. So yeah, that's advice to myself in retrospect. Other tips, as I said earlier, if you're writing, visual, make it visual. Keep the dialogue short. Strong characters, but that's an obvious. That they're all kind of obvious things, but as visual as possible, I'd say.
Awesome. Thank you very much for coming up.
Thank you.
Cheers.
That was Arthur. I loved hearing his take on the TV industry and where it's going and how it's still hard to get things made. I think that's kind of weirdly frustrating to hear, but also reassuring to hear, because I feel like sometimes we all have this perception that once you've had one hit, everyone's going to want to hear every idea you ever have. And I suppose they might listen to you. Like you said, he can email stuff over and they'll probably listen or give him notes, but it doesn't mean that they're going to make it. And it also doesn't mean that it's on trend or it'll fit. And it was just good to hear that firsthand, for me anyway. And I found it really inspiring to hear how he has diversified his career and he's written for other shows and how he just has a confidence in his writing that I feel like a lot of people struggle with when they're putting something together, especially when they're writing on their own. So I can't thank him enough for sharing those experiences and for sharing his take on the industry itself. If you like this episode, you might also like the episode I did with Sam Bain, who is the co-writer of Peep Show. We talked a lot about the TV industry and getting stuff made and also having a cult following for a show by accident. Also, you could take a look back at the episode with Doug Naylor, who wrote Red Dwarf, which we just put out a couple of weeks ago. It was probably about a month ago. So that one's further up the feed if you can't bother to scroll back to Sam's episode, both of which I'm really proud of and I really enjoyed putting together. So I hope you enjoy them as well. If you're new here, please do remember to hit the subscribe button. If you're old here, please do remember to give us an honest, ideally positive review in iTunes. And either way, please do consider to give us a donation. You can do this from £1 on patreon.com at patreon.com/asktheindustrypodcast. Was this worth 80p? Well, it's like in dollars, so I said a pound, I meant a dollar. But is it worth 80p of your money? Do you think you can spare 80p twice a month to keep me making these? If you can, please do join us a Patreon. It really, really helps keep the project going. And if you want to just do a one-off donation, you can do that on PayPal at my website, which is simonkane.co.uk. All donations, big or small, are heavily appreciated. Please do not feel like your donation isn't big enough or that it's not going to be... Whatever's going in your head, like, oh, I'm only going to give a fiver. Everything helps, and I do reply to everyone and say thank you to everyone who donates. So please do continue to support the project in any way you can. The Ask the Industry podcast is a Fruit That Got in Gravity's Way production for the internet. All elements were created by me, comedian Simon Kane. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for subscribing. And thank you very much for rating and donating if you do. I'll see you all in about 14 days' time. Before you go, I just want to quickly say I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival. I'm drilling down the details on dates, times, and all that sort of stuff. But just so you're aware, I'm going to be at the Edinburgh Festival in 2019. I'm also going to be previewing the show from about April onwards around the country. And then I'm going to be on tour in September and October. Now, this is the most vague plug I've done for anything, but essentially I'm going to be updating my website with these details as soon as they are available. Please do keep an eye out for them. I'd really appreciate it, as that would really help. The one thing I can confirm is I am doing a one-off, potentially DVD record. Again, that is something I'm dealing with. I'm sorting it out. Of Sex, Drugs and Other Things I Never Do at the Bloomsbury Theatre in London on the 21st of March 2019. If you can come to that, please do. If you would like to get half off the tickets, tweet me. Tweet me something mysterious like, my favourite macaroon is strawberry flavoured, right? Tweet me that and I would DM you the discount code so you can get money off your tickets to come and see that show live. I'd really love to get some of your listeners in and to watch the show. I'm really, really excited about it, but also really nervous about it, as it's quite a big space, even though it's the studio space. But yeah, I want to get the thing recorded and out the door. So if you can come, please do. If you can't come, please tell a friend and hopefully they'll come. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.